Thank you very much, Jacob.
It's
our pleasure to be here. We certainly are happy that we were invited, and we enjoy coming to Liberty City, as you probably figured out, we kind of grew up downstate. And I have some family here, so it was wonderful to be able to walk my granddaughter to her first day of school this morning. I know. She's only 17. But it is a pleasure to be here, and I'm also glad there aren't a lot of kids in the hall because the Obama administration called us and reminded us if you talk to school children, you have to get permission first. So we didn't get a lot of letters in, and so we assume that's going to be okay. It really is fun to see some students that we had a few years ago, meet some new people, and their new acquaintances, and it's always really is heartwarming in a sense for Doug and I when we've done this to see that some of you actually grew up and made it. It was a challenge, but that's kind of nice. The ones who didn't make it aren't here, and we don't worry about them anymore. So what we'd like to do tonight is talk to you a little bit about what's going on in the economy. Are we on the way up or not? And if we are, which way is up? And we have to just remember one thing. This really is a complex sort of subject. And as you did so many years ago, some of you, give us a break, right? Don't hold us for too much. So with that, let's see if our system works. Okay. First thing to notice is the recession that we're going through and coming out of, we believe, as we'll talk about in a few minutes, is not the same as we've seen in the past. This isn't your standard parents' depression from the 30s or even the recession from the 80s. Things are different this year. First of all, this recession started and came in because of what everybody calls an asset bubble crash in the financial system. It didn't happen because of a downturn in production. It didn't happen because exports fell or anything like that. Housing prices plummeted, and that then pushed much of the rest of the financial system over the edge. And so we saw house prices drop, and in the process, wealth disappeared in phenomenally large numbers, hundreds of billions of dollars. And that made a big impact, and that led then to production cutbacks, layoffs, and the recession. Second thing that's different about this period is we've seen this recession just dramatically move throughout the world. Over 70% of the world's economies were very rapidly involved in this downturn, from the European Union countries to Southeast Asian countries to African countries to South American countries. It's a worldwide, and partly due to the fact that we have globalized, and what happens here has big effects in the rest of the world. And we are highly linked together. And a third part, which we're beginning now to unravel, is that we're seeing a new kind of labor market behavior in this downturn that we don't normally see in a recession and a downturn. One is that many employers have reacted by what we call in labor economics, labor hoarding. That is, rather than firing workers outright, for a long time, firms were reducing work hours, cutting work, hanging on to workers as long as they could. And partly, we think that's because firms have spent over the last 15, 20 years a lot of money investing in their workers, and they don't want to lose them, and they're hard to get them back. And so, in the labor market side, even though the unemployment rate has gone up, it certainly hasn't gone up as high as one normally would expect in a recession this deep. And part of the reason is because firms are holding on to workers. Secondly, we're seeing increased participation in the labor force by people who traditionally withdraw from the labor force in the recession. Young, women, and seniors, right? And part of it is because the asset value wealth loss meant a scramble to try and recover. And so what traditionally were second earners in family suit would not be looking for work in a recession are coming into the labor market. People who are seniors and folks who are retirement staying in the labor market. And that's been very different. Now, to help us see how different this is, Doug's going to take us on a little thought experiment.
That was pretty exciting.
sure they are believers. But basically what we have here are a set of data, of course, on each of the last 10 recessions prior to our current one, which was in 2007. We believe there's kind of a story embedded in these numbers that can help us understand to what extent how this recession differs from previous ones. They indicate how gross domestic product declined from the previous peak. Remember that business cycle up and down, kind of a peak, trough, and expansion, and contraction, and kind of indicates where and how the expansion negative growth occurred from the peak prior to the months here, 3, 6, and so forth, just happened corresponding to quarters. So, as an example, if you were to look at 1953, you can see that by the first quarter, real output declined by 0.6%. Everybody see that? One of those rare redundant numbers. In the second quarter, 6 months out, 2.2.
That's not encouraging.
200 or something. And then it was 2.6. But by about the 18th month here, we see it actually had turned around, and real GDP growth was 0.5% higher than what it was prior to going in. Clearly, it had made that peak that going back. The other thing this provides us with is among these various recessions, where the biggest decline in real GDP actually occurred. And you can see that in 1957, for example, it's -3.7. If you compare that to our current recession, that's really right now how far our real GDP has declined from its peak. But in 57, that was done by the second quarter, and it didn't take too many quarters after that, and we were back into positive growth relative to where we started. So, in this situation, the depth and duration are kind of provide some information both in terms of the length and the degrees to which they go down. We're going to use this table again, but we're going to play a little. First, we're going to straightforward games. We go to the next chart. One of the things we're going to do is, one of the things we're going to do with these data is to construct three more data sets. I like when you do that because you get more things to talk about. What we're going to do is say, suppose that we looked at each of the past 10 recessions and we picked the harshest quarter, first quarter decline, and the harshest second quarter decline, and so on. You can see that in the 1980 recession, the economy fell by 2% in the first quarter. But in the second quarter, we would go into 1957 and see that it was -3.7. And likewise, the 3.1 is the smallest on the chart for the third quarter. And this process continued, -2.7, -3.2, and so forth. The whole purpose of doing this is to come up with kind of an artificial idea of what the worst case scenario would have been in terms of number of quarters by looking at each of the past 10 recessions prior to this. Now, we've done this, I'm going to play the game on it, which doesn't know it. We're going to look at the other side. If you look at the worst case, the harshest, the alternative is the best case, or the mildest, right? So help me by looking across the first quarter and see if you can find the mildest, not counting the current, mildest recession number up there. 2001.7. 7 for 2. All right. So, I'll do for those guys. I got you. All right. Now, that's the first one.
way, you can see 2001 turns out to have been the mildest recession we had. We didn't actually have negative growth. We actually had just slower than normal growth. And so it's still positive, not negative. So point, I believe there, the 0.4 second quarter and the third quarter, 0.9, all right, fourth quarter, no, no. 1.6, good, good. And then 53 and 6 is like 5.5 and so forth. Now, the point is, again, it's just simply to say, okay, suppose we took the best, yes, get the mildest previous recession. And we go on. Now, the tough one is next. And that would be, okay, we got the harshest kind of artificial recession by taking the kind of red numbers here, and we kind of just talked about the mildest recession. What number do you think might represent or correspond to some sort of a typical, normal, or average? Average, good idea, but not quite. There's a couple of measures of central tendency. Remember, the stats class is coming. Aside from the average,
yeah, I heard it. There's a Marshall Dryer to way back.
What was it?
Zero.
Well, it was the median. What you can do is just, okay, we have, in this case, 10 different ones. You take the fifth worst and the sixth worst, you get the average of those two, and I get the midpoint. And the idea, I'm not going to go through these numbers. Here's four, but we'll just tell you we can take those numbers, we get kind of the typical recession on kind of balance, how far do recessions go. And if we take a look at this next slide, and you can see the numbers that we just talked about, the harshest on that previous slide, and the mildest over here, after 2 years, the mildest recession, the real GDP, had grown almost 11.6% higher than what it had been at the beginning of the recession. This median, again, is some sort of a midpoint notion here. We can kind of see where our current recession is relative to that. First 1, 2, 3 quarters, we were in fact not as mild as the mildest, but we were not as harsh as median, because the minus 0.5 is greater than the minus 0.7. So in some ways, this was not quite as harsh in the third quarter. The second quarter, again, 0.2 was not the mildest, and median, certainly greater than that. But then things begin to change rather dramatically, and then by the fifth and sixth quarter there, things start to go south a little bit. Visually, you can see this with the next graph, I think, that reproduces kind of zero growth, no change in your GDP across here, and then looks at those wild ones, where we actually have no negative growth, but some positive growth, all the way up to close to 12% by 2 years' time. And the next graph, this shows the median, and then our final graph, or not the final, but the next last, looks at the harshest. So again, we construct those to get kind of a sense of where past recessions might have been in terms of their relative mildest, median, harshest. Now, of course, if we now put our current, we can see that after 5 quarters, the current recession has gone further south than our most harsh previous recession, last 10. And this is an indication clearly of the severity, as well as the overall length of that. The previous 10-year recessions, on average, from about 6 months to 16 months, we've averaged about 10 and a half months. And we're already getting out here to 18 months. Probably up by 3 years, 6 years, so that's a little bit longer than we currently have. Some people are calling this the Great Recession instead of the Great Depression. Now, we did this same kind of thing. These another economic statistic. Instead of real GDP, just a measure of the economic value of the economy, we look at the employment side of this. And I'm not going to put the chart up with the numbers, but what we're going to do is just say, as we look at what happened to employment over time, we again get to see that in terms of the mildest, medium, and harshest, these are kinds of, this is kind of what has happened over time with the previous 10 recessions that we've had. Now, if we take this and look at our economies, we can see we just got some data on last Friday that suggested that the unemployment rate rose to 9.7, I think, and output has fallen down by 5 percentage points from where it was prior to the recession. Clearly, another indicator that this current recession will be one to measure some of the future harshest or worst recessions that we've had. So, I think the next thing that we can discuss some of those reasons for it. That's why I wrote this one.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we look at the numbers today, and what gets excited about that was in the past classes, remember that. But let's get to the real truth of the matter here. You know, what was really going on? Well, it's clear, it's pretty clear, that the housing market collapse, as we mentioned before, was one of the primary starters. Once housing prices stopped going up, right, then all sorts of bad things happened in the financial markets. Part of the reason we think the housing market collapsed is we had a conscious policy for at least 10 years of trying to increase home ownership. And that led to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the long, beloved Countrywide and all those other financial institutions at Echo to loosen up their lending requirements. They were not very severely regulated, and they were encouraged by the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, even into the beginning of the Obama administration to look for new housing owners. It's apparently a good policy. Secondly, going back to the Greenspan years, right? Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve System, all of you remember the Federal Reserve System, I'm sure, wanted low interest rates for a number of reasons, partially to prevent the 2001 recession from getting worse, partly to make it easier for housing lending, for lenders to get funds and for people to qualify. And so with monetary policy, we had historically low interest rates. They were, for a long period of time, hovering well below the medium-term treasury bill rate, well below 6%, 5%, 4%. And that led investors to search for higher return opportunities. When you can only get 2 or 3%, in what you were investing in, you say, can't I do better? And so all of those things we started to read about, credit default swap instruments, collateralized mortgage debt obligations, that whole alphabet soup of financial instruments that paid a little bit more, became very attractive. And that spread throughout the world as well. That is, you may remember, Iceland got into this game big time, and their banking system said from a quarter, half a percent, we can do better for our population, our retirees, and retirement funds in Europe, some banks in Europe, started to buy this, and so these new, novel, relatively unknown securities spread throughout the world, many of them tied to housing prices. And as long as housing prices went up and people paid their mortgages, things were good. Unfortunately, with the supply chain linkage and all the firms tied together, and all of this investment in these new securities, we think that is the age groups. All of these age groups, the young, middle-aged, and elderly, all of them saw rather significant increases in the number, percentage of families that were able to buy and own their home. And that's usually a pretty good thing, to own your home and live in it and take care of it, where you invest in the neighborhood. And this program was very successful. We could have sliced this by gender, we could have sliced it by race, we could have sliced it by education, and you get the same picture. Home ownership grew rather nicely. In fact, if you look back from 1981, this is where the policy then started to kick in the early 90s, when the government was worried about home ownership rates falling. And in fact, the program was quite successful, pushing home ownership from 65% to close to 70%. And when you recognize that people do move, and not everybody wants to own a home, 70% is almost like having full employment in the labor market. We're getting near the top. But housing prices collapsed, foreclosures started to happen, and people started to get worried. And here's part of our takeaway for those of you worried about our takeaway portion. We claim that if we had dealt with the housing foreclosure problem early on, recognized it as it should have been, had been regulated properly so we could identify it, this whole recession, or much of this recession, never needed to happen. And the way we sort of pencil it out is if we look at the number of housing, 75 million homes, right? The average value when the collapse started was about $220,000 throughout the nation. So we had $16.5 trillion worth of housing value out there. Now, about 90% do carry a mortgage, and so that's 67.5 million homes. Because some of that mortgage is paid down, the average value of a mortgage was $165,000. So we had $11.1 trillion in mortgage debt being held by people. These are all these new financial instruments plus the old types of mortgages. If we just started 4%, which is a phenomenally high number of foreclosures, foreclosure rates usually went under 1%. So if we quadruple the foreclosure rate to 4%, that means at the beginning, 2.7 million households would have defaulted on their mortgage, would have been foreclosure. These would have been slightly less valuable on average properties, so the average foreclosure would have been about $148,000. We would have had 401 billion dollars worth of loss of financial wealth. We say that's a big number. But if you then say, suppose everybody who held a portfolio, an investment portfolio, if we just shared equally in that $401 billion loss, we could have all taken a $5,000 hit in our 401ks, our retirement plans, our pensions, paid off the whole thing, and the foreclosure crisis is over. Right? Now, I would claim most of us here, but most of us here took more than a $5,000 hit in our 201Ks, our 101Ks, and we could go one day in our 401Ks again, right? We could have bought our way out of this pretty inexpensively had we had the willingness to do that, had we had the political savvy to see what was going on and get through it. So much of this current financial crisis, of course, is our own doing. And what would have hurt would have been the 2.7 million people who would have lost their homes. And that would have been a real pain and suffering, but not nearly as bad as we ended up with now with the current rate at which housing is being foreclosed. So this was an avoidable recession, is our point. Well, we got it. So what are we doing about it? Well, remember back when we took economics, and hopefully you all have great memories of that. We just talked about two types of policies, fiscal and the other type. And so fiscal policy is the role of the government in making sure we get through the recession. And fiscal policy, the good news is, those of you that are real old graduates, we're back to everybody being Keynesian again, right? We obviously monitor us under Reagan, and now we're all back to tax and spending. And that's exactly what's going on. And it is working. The TARP money does help. The Recovery Act, $767 billion, does make a difference, but we're back to what you learned back when you took a class for better from Much of the spending is focused on infrastructure, the shovel-ready stuff, and that makes an awful lot of good sense. This is an investment in the future, right? You certainly can remember many up in Minneapolis, the bridge that fell, and lots of other structures, and we have literally trillions of dollars worth of infrastructure that could be fixed. And so that makes a lot of sense. And the tax rebates and incentives for consumers, the cash for clunkers made a big difference, right? Anybody here in the office used to be in the automobile industry? It's gone. But it made a big difference, right? The first time homebuyer, $8,000, a whole lot of tax rebates. And there's a lot of energy conservation tax incentives out there. So monetary policy or fiscal policy kicked in just exactly the way we used to teach you it should work. And it's being rather successful. It does take time, but it's starting to make a difference.
Now we look at monetary policy. Before we go to the side of the fiscal policy, we remember some of those discussions had to be the multiplier effect. If the government spends this much, in fact, the effect on the economy is 4 or 5 times as much. There's certainly some debate currently going on about the magnitude of the multipliers, and clearly those numbers like 4 or 5 are certainly not. But like fiscal policy, monetary policy, you know, responded in many of the really traditional ways. We lower interest rates, but less costly to borrow from the banks. The Fed funds rate is pressed all the way down to zero. And the Fed has, in fact, provided liquidity in non-traditional forms this past year because of the crisis, providing almost $1 trillion worth of liquidity to the economy. It's so much that, again, they call for them. And basic economics that Friedman said inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Many people think now that extra money that's been pumped in may, in fact, lead to inflation. Many people are responding to that kind of thing by looking at commodities like oil or gold. Cab driver told us on the way from the airport said we should buy in fact, they're responding to that same kind of response, but basically the process is that this process, like the fiscal policies, are having an effect on the economy. We do think that the economy is coming out of recession, unlike many other economies. We do believe this third quarter, but this year, over the end, may very well reflect the change in the economy's performance. If you look here, it's at 08, and then it's
that's why I brought my son tonight. He understands how this stuff works. While we're doing this, I just point out, watch the two red lines, right? Because that's what people have been worrying about a little bit today. Is the deficit a cripple and will be up out of the place short? Now, that was the same.
We looked at the output of the economy, growth, and real GDP. These are quarter values annualized, so this is the annualized rate of decline in each of the quarters. And this is the most recent quarter that's available, the second quarter. And as you can see, this third quarter of this year, 2009, points to transition from negative growth to positive growth. And the difference is not just 2.1%, but from a negative 1 to 2.1, which is a little bit greater than that. But this projection is not one that suggests that output is necessarily going to go to some amount substantially higher than the traditional long-term growth in output. But basically, for the first couple of quarters in 2010, approach the 2.5% level, and actually that number of growth in output is not necessarily going to get us back to rates of unemployment that are low. We expect it takes almost a 2.5% great state, let alone get some of the transition for people that have lost their jobs and are coming back. So we do have some recovery concerns.
Yeah, Doug points out, we expect the recovery has started and will continue and won't be a boom, but it will be recovery, but there are some concerns. Right? One is we're going to have, at least for the first few quarters, what people call a jobless recovery. Remember, firms have been hoarding workers, holding on to them, so as their orders pick up and as they start to get more demand for their output, we're not going to see a tremendous number of new jobs being created. Second concern is 3 months ago people were worried about deflation. This week they're worried about inflation, but it's clear, as Doug pointed out, the Federal Reserve System has created a huge amount of liquidity in the banking system. And those of you that took Doug's money in banking course know that each one of those dollars that banks sit on, all those excess reserve dollars, can, if they're used, create a lot more money. And so the money supply has the potential to gigantically expand. It's worth an uncharted territory. And if we did that, we'd have serious runaway inflation. And we think the Fed would be able to perform its traditional balancing act and manage that. But there is a risk of some significant inflation if the Fed makes a mistake. You read a lot about people's savings. So in the paper this morning, savings rates up again. People aren't buying. The U.S. economy is driven 70% by consumer spending. People don't spend. Where are those new orders going to come from? Well, again, if you remember, if you took the macroeconomics course from me, not from Doug, savings go somewhere. It can and should end up with business firms who are new investment in plant and equipment, new infrastructure, all of that. And so we don't think that the fact that U.S. consumers are saving was necessarily going to hinder the economy. As Doug pointed out, it would slow down the speed at which the recovery takes off. But once firms get optimistic again, all that savings will start to be new plants and new equipment. And he said, well, later, but we also think, although we're tenuous on this, so you put it up on the slide, we think the manufacturing sector is coming back. Not cars, probably not airplanes, but nanotechnology, bioengineering, all of this new sophisticated manufacturing process that requires lots of brains and jobs of making things is where the U.S. will emerge again, and the more traditional factory manufacturing will in fact continue to move offshore. And so we think manufacturing is coming back, it'll just be different. And that's where a lot of that savings goes. And building those fancy, sophisticated manufacturing plants. And then the other concern we've got, of course, is will we panic and will we create trade barriers and try and export more goods and import less? And if we do that, other countries will respond and there'll be reciprocal policy changes and we'll be back. Some of you maybe remember the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of the 1930s that turned another mild recession into a Great Depression. And we're a little bit fearful that it's very easy to beggar our neighbors and say, we want to create more jobs, so we're not going to import your goods. They'll do the same to us. And then we've got a real problem. We hope that's not going to happen. That's one of those things to keep in the back of your mind as a concern.
We talked about unemployment. And as I said, just Friday, the most recent month data came out, we have finally hit the 9.7% unemployment rate. You can see that that's not as high as we had in the 81 recession there, but we started this recession at 4.7% unemployment. So it's as proportionate, it more than increased by 100%, double the rate of unemployment. But one reason we're showing this graph also is the fact that so many people look at just the unemployment rate. We want you to be aware that the unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. If you look at all these past gray lines here that kind of correspond to recessions, what you find is just prior to the recession, we start off usually with a pretty low unemployment rate, and then right at the end of the recession, you start to see it coming down. You don't see that until the very end of the recession. And for all reasons that Bruce has talked about, this evening, there's so some concern about the speed and adjustment of the downward unemployment rate pressure that we might anticipate getting over this. You know, we were having unemployed people rising by numbers greater than 500,000 or 600,000 a month just this spring. The most recent amount of unemployed people this last month turned out to be a little over 100,000. It takes about 125,000 jobs to be created each month just to keep up with kind of the natural number of increase of job seekers from immigration or from population growth. So if you're losing 500,000, it takes an extra 125,000. You've got a lot of people that are out there in this pool of unemployed. It's tough. 10% unemployment is, many economists would argue or think that the unemployment would be before the year ends. And Moody's predicts, I can't remember the term or notion of the natural rate of unemployment, the full employment. About 5%, 5.5% may remember that. Moody's kind of suggests that we won't see that until almost 2014, so another 5 or 6 years before this gets all the way down to some sort of a natural rate in that 5%. We've got periods where it's less than that, periods where it's greater than that, but that's kind of the story. So,
so, yeah, what we're suggesting to you is the recession kicking in, that's not news, in 2007. It's going to be a long and slow recovery. The recovery is going to start late in 2009, and we'll start to really see it. We're going to see continued expansion through 2010. We caution you not to watch the unemployment rate. People are going to misread this and say the unemployment rate's going up or not coming down. We're still in recession. We won't be. Think to keep an eye on prices. We're a little bit worried about inflation becoming a significant problem, but we hope that's not going to be the case. And even though we're all Keynesians now, much depends on what the Federal Reserve System does. Now, the good news is, Ben Bernanke, who runs the Federal Reserve System, is a great scholar of the Great Depression. And he's made it pretty clear he doesn't want to go back. So we're pretty comfortable that he knows what he's doing. He made a lot of right moves early and kept this thing from getting a lot worse. Now, a quick postscript, right? You might recall that it's highly related to recessions. And Doug and I have spent the last 4 years doing a lot of deep research on this. And if you notice, as we're coming out of the recession here at the end of 09, it's pretty clear to us that this is the
Wow.
Thank you.